what I see is people splitting into vegan and omnivore. And I think we need to like bring that conversation back around to what is the role of grazing animals in a built growing soil, in a healthy landscape, etc. What is the cost to animals that maybe aren't so cute and whatever, or you know, lovable as a cow or a chicken or a hog or something like that? What is the cost of growing the corn and the soybeans? Because when you till the soil, when you spray herbicides, you are killing millions of mice and voles and then birds that are used to eating those, and foxes and weasels, and also the soil microbes, and etc. So, and you are killing tons of wildlife in lakes and streams and in the ocean.
Welcome to the Real Organic Podcast. I'm Lindley Dixon, co-director of the Real Organic Project, a grassroots farmer-led movement with an add-on organic food label distinguishing crops grown in healthy soils and pasture-raised livestock under the organic seal. You just heard from Dee Dee Piercehouse, a former medical practitioner who has turned her attention towards regenerating soils. Remember, each of our podcast episodes is also available on our website and YouTube channel as a video version. In this episode, Dee Dee gives us a great visual demonstration of the soil carbon sponge, and it's a visual that really sticks with you and will help kids learn about healthy soils as well. You can certainly listen along as she described it, but it's even better on video. So let's get back to my co-director Dave Chapman's interview with the Land and Leadership Institute founder, Dee Dee Piercehouse.
Welcome to the Real Organic Podcast, and my guest today is Dee Dee Piercehouse. Welcome, Dee Dee.
Thanks.
Dee Dee is the author of The Ecology of Care and is also an old friend. And I will say that at least we have shared at least part of our journey on this. I think that my understanding of the relationship to soil and climate and nutrition really, really took a great leap forward when I went to the first workshop that you hosted with Walter Yena. And I remember sharing with you after that explorations that were exciting for me.
Yeah.
So I know that for you an awful lot has happened in the last 6 or 8 years, building on everything that came before. So was that a turning point for you, or was that just a natural continuation of what you were doing before?
The conference?
Yes, yeah. The conference. It really was a really powerful conference, bringing Walter, and a lot of people came together, you know, in Vermont to, is it 2 days, 3 days? It was a lot.
It was three or four,
I think. Yeah, it was intensive. Yeah.
Well, certainly those conferences have been the soil sponge conferences that we've hosted every year for the last few years at Lake Maury have been a real touch point for kind of wrapping up and deepening the learning for the year. I think there are a bunch of key points of me getting into this sort of aha moments. One was Hurricane Irene. Mm-hmm. Where I suddenly understood that climate change wasn't just about carbon and that it wasn't just about things getting warmer, that it was really about water in terms of how we experience it, and also water in terms of it being a big piece of what's driving, what creates the climate that we can live in and what's driving some of the change. So, and that understanding came about over a period of time. So first just experiencing the flooding, having thought that Vermont was going to be kind of immune to climate. And then looking at the links between public health and climate change, because my background was in holistic healthcare. That's what I'd been doing for 20 years. And shifting the book that I was then writing, The Ecology of Care, to include that whole picture of climate and public health, and how do we incorporate that into our sense of health. They're reading Judith Schwartz's book, Cows Save the Planet, was another big turning point. And that was really the one where I, mid-book, said, this is what I want to do for the rest of my life. Yeah. So, and shifted pretty much overnight away from primarily being a healthcare provider to figuring out how I could use the understanding about soil to shift public health and environmental health at the same time.
So could we say that soil is the hub of the spokes that have become your life?
Yeah, I would. I would say so. The soil sponge is the term I like to use, and increasingly, I'm thinking of it's not really the soil specifically. It's that interface. It's that space where sunlight, plants, microbes, minerals, and animals interact at the surface, and it's strangely missing from a lot of models in terms of my friend John Norman, who wrote the textbook on environmental biophysics, talks about the fact that soil physicists study the movement of water underground and hydrologists study the movement of water across the land. But neither one of them studies the top few inches of topsoil because it's too close to the other one's discipline. And therefore, the models that the hydrologists have developed about how water moves across land completely don't fit with the models that soil physicists have developed to predict how soil moves down into the soil and sideways below the soil. And that's a kind of a perfect description of where we get lost, is that we don't look at relationships between things. We look at things as individual disciplines. So there's a different academic department for this part of a system, a living system, than this part. And there's a different government bureaucracy to take care of flooding versus algal blooms versus food security versus public health versus immigration, and yet those are all the same thing. They're all related to that interface.
Okay. And I think climate is another discipline that, is it, do you think in the study of climate that has become a more connected to the what's happening in those top 5 inches of the soil?
I'm not up on exactly where the models are at. There are a lot of different climate models now. I like the phrase that all models are wrong, some are useful, which is a modeler's phrase. I know that, for example, cloud formation is considered probably the most difficult thing out there to model, and that's a key piece of both climate change, climate resilience, so albedo from clouds, but also, you know, how do hazes turn into clouds, how does rain, you know, when, who's getting rain, who's getting rain, who's getting flooding, all of that is so bound up in the capacity of water to shift from one phase to another, to shift from a liquid to a gas to a solid as it freezes. And biology is involved in all those levels. And biology is constantly making intelligent, adaptive decisions. And so that's an aspect of climate change that is huge for the carbon cycle. So, you know, how much photosynthesis is happening, how much of the carbohydrates that a plant makes are being fed out through their roots as soil carbon that's now not in the atmosphere. How much are they transpiring and cooling locally? How does that impact weather coming in? There's so many factors. So to model that is nearly impossible. But to say, can we cool a landscape? Can we cool a region by having more green growing plants? Is a kindergartner's question. Well, maybe fourth grader.
Yeah.
So the basic science, we learn this stuff in elementary school. Everything that we need to know to address climate change through biology.
Actually, I don't think I did learn.
Well, if you're like me, you went to hippie schools. No.
But that's good.
Right, yeah.
That's good. That's what education to be.
Photosynthesis and transpiration. Maybe we learned it in high school. I don't know. But we learned it. It was in there in the curriculum.
Yeah. I learned those things rather laboriously as an older adult because I actually skipped science in high school.
Okay.
So, I literally just skipped it. So, yeah. Not because it isn't interesting, but because the way it was presented wasn't interesting to me.
Right.
It's very interesting now.
Yeah.
So let's talk about it and unpack it a little bit for people who are not familiar with some of these ideas. You talked about, it seems like the soil is central, the plants are central. You can't really take anything out and say, you know, that's not important. It's all important. The connections are important. So the plants are the vehicle for photosynthesis, primary vehicle.
Plants on land and in the oceans.
And in the
are what? And I'm trying to get away from a mechanical metaphor. So the plants, the work that they do is photosynthesis. That is one of the primary forms of work that they do. And they're the only thing that really does that other than the things that have some plant
Yes.
going on in them, like lichens. So.
And that photosynthesis is the engine for life.
Yes.
Yeah. And so could you talk about some of the ways in which, because we've talked about it, it's very interesting, some of the ways in which plants share the products of photosynthesis with the rest of life.
Right. Well, so photosynthesis, just for a quick review, is basically plants taking CO2, that same CO2 that we're worried about with climate change, and combining it with water that they get primarily through their root systems from what I call the soil sponge, and using that, transforming it into sugars, carbohydrates they first grow themselves, and then they also give out the estimates vary, but somewhere between 30 and 60% of those sugars out through their root system to feed underground life. And then through their above and below ground physical plant bodies that they have grown, they feed everything in the world. So you're either eating a plant or you're eating something that ate a plant.
Right.
So
let's go back just for a second, because that is an important statement. So 30 to 60% of the products made from photosynthesis by plants, they exude out their roots rather than building more leaf, more stem, more branch. They're exuding these photosynthates to feed the life in the soil, the microbial life.
Yep.
And the bigger life, the macro life, too.
Yeah, so there's a food chain underground, just like there is above ground. And so these plant root exudates, which is essentially liquid sugars or liquid carbon, carbohydrates, there are different communities that eat those directly, or eat, maybe not quite the right word, but take them in directly. There are the bacteria that live in the root zone that have a whole little soil food web within their own communities, eating each other and being eaten by larger things. And the plants, in that life process, the plants get nutrients from them. Then there are mycorrhizal fungi that actually are a symbiotic symbiont with a plant. Mycorrhizae is actually the description of the symbiosis there. So it's the mycorrhizal fungi is actually growing into the root and extends the plant's root system out tremendously, providing much more access to different nutrients in the soil, much more ability to intelligently search for nutrients, as well as access to hidden water during dry periods. So these mycorrhizal fungi can access water that's kind of like the water that's sticking to the inside of a glass, that if you were to stick a paper towel in there, you could get it, but you couldn't drink it directly. It's a little bit like that. So in a cubic meter or square yard of or a cubic yard of healthy soil, there can be 25,000 kilometers of these mycorrhizal hyphae, which are they're like little roots themselves, little threads, doing work that they are finding and delivering nutrients back to the plants in the right ratios, at the right timing that the plant needs in order to be resilient, to ward off diseases, etc. There are also mycorrhizae in the forest system and between plants that are shuttling information back and forth between plants, saying, hey, there's a infestation of this pest, or there's this virus coming. Here's some nutrients to make something to ward it off. So what that means is that a plant that's grown in a setting, in a context that can develop those mycorrhizal relationships, that plant has more access to intelligence, that the soil is more intelligent for that plant. The plant becomes much more healthy and vibrant, much less prone to disease, much less prone to rot on the shelf in a supermarket. And people who are eating those plants, or animals that are eating those plants, and then people or other animals that are eating those animals, are getting a balanced, appropriate nutrition for the moment, for what's going on in the world now. So if we eat local, fresh food grown in an undisturbed no-till system, if we eat perennial food, berries, avocados, it's all these superfoods that we talk about, right? Fruits, nuts. And if we eat animal products that are grown in a grass-fed, pasture-based, diverse, undisturbed landscape, we're basically making our bodies more intelligent. We're benefiting from the intelligence of that soil system.
So these are the foundational ideals of organic agriculture. They are not, this doesn't work because we are so clever.
No.
Our cleverness is to embrace the way things have evolved and the way we have evolved. We are part of the system. It's not something that, happened over there. We are a part of it.
Yep. Okay. Yep. Absolutely. And I mean, at this point, we've mostly played a destructive role in it, but that doesn't need to continue. I mean, that's not a given. But what we need to really do is to understand and respect that the intelligence of the system, that every living community is a self-organizing, intelligent community that is trying to develop more and more intelligence. It's trying to learn. It's trying to grow more of this soil sponge infrastructure. And that soil sponge, which we'll do a bread and flour demonstration in a little bit, is basically the infrastructure that allows life on land to happen. So every time that we go through with heavy tillage or disturb it or use biocides in the system, we are breaking up the infrastructure for life.
And you would include chemical fertilizers as part of those biocides?
Yeah.
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 Yeah. They have some obviously measurable effect on the growing plants, but they have things that are not necessarily obvious to us that are negative. And I think that's, you know, we have to have complex conversations about these things, because the system that you're describing, this enormously intelligent system that wasn't our intelligence, wasn't human intelligence, seems to be in conflict with our basic economic systems.
Well, that's what I'm writing about right now, is the idea that other species are essential workers, often frontline workers. And other species are also designers, like continually designing for success in amidst a lot of different challenges. And that other species, in economic terms, are also investors in the landscape. And we have not figured out how to recognize that work in our economy, how to value that work in our economy, nor have we figured out a currency that can provide a return on investment to those investors who are other species. I don't really like the economic language, but I think it's really important to develop it and think about that, because that's the level that we need to be. That's the level that we need to be intervening in the system, it's as basic as our economy, that we're not recognizing there's a parallel economy, or there's not even parallel. It's like that economy of living systems enfolds our own. Yeah. And that until we recognize that, our societies are going to keep failing. Our civilizations, our land, our farms are going to fail.
All right. You know, I think one of the things that is a tremendous struggle for us is that our food is the cheapest food in the history of the world. In modern America, it's much cheaper than in Europe right now. It's cheaper than it's ever been in America. By cheaper, I mean it costs a smaller percentage of our income mm-hmm. on average. Mm-hmm. And at the very same time, our healthcare costs are the highest in the history of the world. Not our health, just our healthcare costs. Yeah. So we have this obvious contradiction that we're struggling with, that we're paying more elsewhere for where we're apparently saving money here. You started, I believe, looking at this from the perspective of health, of human health, and then of health of the system, and that, I understand, you pull that string and you find it's attached to everything. One of the places it comes back to is you talk about the soil carbon sponge. So you've talked about the plants taking light energy, turning it into food for organisms. Can we talk about what happens? How do we create a sponge out of soil? What does that mean?
So maybe this is the place to do the demo?
Sure, that would be okay. Fine.
And this is a soil sponge demo during COVID. I'm taping up little broken plates here. No organic flower at Wings. So this demonstration is one that I have used all over the world and is now being used all over the world by people I don't even know. I saw a group of farmers in Andhra Pradesh doing it in November, which was really great fun. It's being used as a way to teach about soil and water interactions, and also how central the soil sponge is to all of the challenges that we're facing right now in the world, So let's just name a few of those off. We've got wildfires, we've got flooding, we've got drought, we've got immigration, like forced migration of people who are struggling with rising seas and flooding and drought, et cetera. We've got water security issues, food security issues.
Wars,
subsidence, where aquifers are being emptied and land is collapsing in. What else have we got? Mudslides.
Poisoned aquifers. Iowa.
Algae blooms.
The island of death, you know, at the end of the Mississippi.
I mean,
yeah.
Okay.
Tremendous problems with water.
So, and then we have, of course, failing human health connected to all of those things. And we have rising temperatures, the climate change. And we have too much CO2 in the atmosphere. So how do we, like, how in the world are we possibly going to address all of those things? I mean, there's no budget large enough to fix all of those, right? Okay. So this plate of flour is representing the mineral portion of soils, just broken down rocks, just sand, silt, and clay. And when a soil gets degraded, that's basically what it goes back down to. Or in theory in soil science, that's the foundation of soils, is that soils get weathered by various means. And then you have different proportions of sand, silt, and clay in the soil. So if a soil is degraded back down to just the mineral portion, what happens when a big wind comes along? So
here we go.
Right? We have a dust bowl. We have dust coming to the U.S. from other continents. We have dust blowing from the Midwest through to both coasts, depending on where things are blowing. And that dust creates all kinds of health issues. Just the dust itself. Now that dust also includes pesticides, antibiotic-resistant bacteria from feedlots. It includes the toxins that are left over after wildfires burn houses. So keeping that dust down is a big concern. And clearly, a degraded soil is not helping with that. What happens if we have a big rainstorm, or even a small rainstorm, on just sand, silt, and clay? So I'm going to make a little rain cloud here. Can you see this?
Yes.
Okay. So we're going to rain a little bit onto this soil. And you see, as soon as it starts raining, that topsoil is starting to degrade. And we're getting erosion, we're getting runoff. We've got a flood developing after like a quarter of an inch of rain here. And of course, if you put a little Monopoly house on there, it would be down the hill. And the water that's running off is not clean or clear either. It now has all that same stuff that would be in the air. So it's got the mineral particles, but it also has the pesticides. It also has any oil spills that were there, and anything that's on the surface of the land is now being washed into the rivers, lakes, going down into the ocean. The fertilizers, huge problem with algae blooms in lakes and oceans and ponds. If you fly across the country, you'll see turquoise splotches of water all across the country, and that's not the color that water's supposed to be in the Midwest. You'll also see here that on the surface, you're starting to develop a crust almost instantly. And what happens in actual soils is that the smallest particles move sideways more quickly than the larger ones, and they fill in the open holes so that the next time it rains, it has a harder time going in. So any pores that were open get plugged up. And then, of course, if you put this out in the sun on a hot day, that's going to bake into a crust. And that's where we start to see soils that are really fully sealed. And no matter how much rain you get, it's going to go sideways there. So, of course, bare soils have other issues, degraded soils that there's no water going down there for the plant roots. So it's harder to get plants to grow, which also means that you're not getting any transpiration, which means you're getting less cooling. That bare soil surface is also having, it's radiating more heat off of it. So if you think about the difference between a parking lot or standing on grass, or even just standing from bare, hot, sealed soil to moss. So even with just a tiny bit of biology, you start getting a little bit of cooling and sponginess. Okay, so what do you do to turn flour into bread? You add biology, right? So with actual bread, you're adding yeast. In soils, we're adding biology through plants. So let's put a few plants in here. So once you get plants growing, they're used taking solar energy, and they are taking CO2 and water. Oh, that one's a dead plant, but even that can help. And they are turning it into themselves, and they're turning it into root exudates that are going down out and taking these individual little mineral particles and sticking them together. So they're sticky sugars that the plants are exuding that then the mycorrhizal fungi are picking up. Hello, chickens. and the mycorrhizal fungi, those hyphae, as they grow and break down, they turn into other glues, but they're also threads while they're living, and the plant root hairs are threads. And everything that's living under the soil, all the bacteria, all of the other soil biology, it's all exuding these slimes and glues. Like think about egg whites and snail slimes and boogers and right. We all exude those slimes and glues. It's part of life. Yeah, even you guys. So they say, who's talking about egg whites? So these little particles suddenly are forming a living matrix. So they're stuck together with these glues. They're tied together with these threads of the root hairs and the fungal hyphae. And then life, the roots, the worms, all of the little nematodes, etc., are moving through that soil and creating passageways. And suddenly you have something that has structure, and it also has function. And if you think about a kitchen sponge, a kitchen sponge works because it has two things. It has pores in it that it will absorb the water, but it also has structural integrity, so when you put it in the sink, it doesn't fall apart. So a soil sponge has those two things too. It's got to have the ability to infiltrate the water, but it also has to have structural integrity when it's wet. And if you think about dried egg white or dried slime, that's where that water resistance comes in. So you have water acceptance and water resistance in one structure. Okay, so what happens when we rain on a soil sponge? When we rain on a soil sponge, well, first of all, the plants are breaking the water, the impact of the water just a little bit here because we don't have a lot of plants. But okay, that was about as much as I put on there, about a half an inch or so. And we don't have any flooding or anything. It's going right to the plant roots. We don't have any erosion happening. So that's twice as much water. That's three times as much water. No flooding. But now we're starting to get a little bit of water coming down out the bottom. But notice the difference in the water that's coming out the bottom. It is clean and clear, and it's refilling the aquifer. It's going down and maybe moving sideways into the rivers and the streams gradually. So we don't have those peak flows right after a rainstorm. We have rivers, streams, lakes, ponds that have a consistent water in them and clean water in them. We have aquifers that are refilling from the rain. We have water available for the roots. We have no flooding. We don't have a drought because this water is protected from evaporation by being down underground. And by having that consistent water at the root zone for plants, the plants can then keep photosynthesizing, keep growing, and keep transpiring. And transpiring is like sweat. It's how the plants get rid of excess water and cool off. And that helps the plants stay cooler, but it also makes the air around the plants dramatically cooler. So what are we addressing here? What have we addressed of all of those problems we listed? Okay, so one thing we haven't talked about here is that as those plants are growing using that water, they're photosynthesizing and taking CO2 to make more of themselves, to make deeper roots, to feed more of those sugars to the soil biology, to build a deeper sponge, and to create more soil carbon. So we're addressing the excess CO2 in the air. We're also providing regional cooling through that transpiration that's happening by having a continual supply of water at the root zone. We have flood prevention because the water is going down first. And of course, this has a plate at the bottom, but in most landscapes, you would have more than that before you get to rock ledge. So flood and drought are minimized quite a bit. If wind comes along, we don't have a dust storm, so air quality is improved. We don't have all of those pesticides going into the water or the air because they're being held in place, and also the water is getting filtered before it gets into the aquifer, before it gets into the pond. Food and water security. We're refilling wells. We're growing more food here, dramatically more food. In a seasonal rainfall environment, we're creating a longer green growing season so we can grow more crops. We can have that cooling for longer. We're providing cooler places for all of the soil biology to live. The surface temperature is dramatically different from a bare degraded soil to a soil sponge. If there's enough food and water, And people are healthy and the economy is flourishing, then generally people are happier to stay where they are. Public health improves, less money spent on public health issues, less money spent on depression and despair and addictions, less need for people to migrate to other places. On a larger scale, this is actually helping to prevent ocean rise. Part of ocean rise isn't just the melting glaciers. It's land. It's water running off of land that should be absorbed. So we can see in a city storm system, you can see that all of that water is just being taken off of the pavement and sent right out to the ocean. And Michael Kravchuk has calculated that that's actually a significant piece of what we're seeing in ocean rise. Because we have now whole continents that aren't absorbing water because of the way that we've treated the land. So what else haven't we addressed yet? We've got algal blooms are clearing up because we don't have those fertilizers running off.
Yeah. It's a lot. It's a lot. I think it's really fascinating and important. It sounds so easy to say, but I believe it's true that you have a whole different level of social justice when you have a local agriculture that feeds people and that they can be sustained by.
So how do you make a soil sponge? And I've started calling it just the soil sponge, even though I like soil carbon sponge, but a lot of people hear soil carbon sponge and they start talking about carbon sponging. And what we're really talking about is sponge in the sense of the water uptake. So it's not that it isn't also building soil carbon, but that people are very distracted by the word carbon these days. So I've been just calling it a soil sponge more and more. So So there are some basic principles that we can see all around us. And here we're in a natural landscape. One of the things that nature does to help build a sponge, to grow a sponge, is to have diverse plants in it and diverse animals and diverse insects, etc. So anything that we can do to increase diversity that's happening all at the same time. So it's different than crop rotation, where you have diversity over time. Nothing wrong with crop rotation, but it's not gonna do it really in the long term. The other thing that nature does is that nature, other than small little pockets here and there with squirrels or snakes, etc., nature is not wholesale tilling up the landscape. It gets to stay undisturbed and grow itself. So this sponge is growing. It's taking the organic matter that's happening right there, and it's decomposing it and adding it to the sponge. It's taking the plant root exudates from the roots that are growing there, and it's using it to grow the soil sponge. So both the recyclers and the living carbon are all staying in the system here. And it's not getting tilled up, which when we till soils, a lot of the life of the soil dies off, and a lot of the carbon in the soil goes back to the atmosphere. But even perhaps more importantly, it's like throwing this bread in a blender. It won't have that function anymore. So let's see. What else do we do? What else can we see here in nature that's happening? So we've got diversity. We've got no tillage, little disturbance as possible. We have living roots in the ground. So the certain plants are perennials, and they are constantly feeding the soil. The grass is actually photosynthesizing even under the snow a lot of the time here in Vermont. So we're feeding the soil biology year round as much as possible. So whatever we can do on a farm that looks like that, that's going to be different for different farmers depending on their goals. But and we also have cover on the soil. So whenever we have mulch that's kind of growing from under the grass. So it's like dead plants that are there along with the living plants that gradually decomposes, feeds those, the saprophytic fungi and the chewers and the shredders. And that layer of mulch, and we can kind of do that here with some of this, that layer provides a lot of protection from the rain hitting the soil. When rain hits soil directly and it doesn't have any blanket layer over it, it's actually very compacting. So making sure that you have both living plants and also plants that are decomposing, which in a natural system, you don't have to add that. It's just there, just part of the life cycle when you have a diverse group of things growing. These are the soil health principles that I'm describing. Another one is to integrate animals into the system or allow animals to be in the system. So that could be grazing animals, grazing livestock, grazing birds, so chickens, turkeys, or wild birds. Could be wild grazing animals, but also insects are also a form of grazer higher up in the canopy generally, but noting that there are species moving through that are taking some of the plant material and sending it through their digestive tract and then putting new microbes, new nutrients out into the land and also bringing things from one place to another. Those animals are also helping to bring seeds from one place to another. Now, a farmer may or may not want those seeds in there, but if you're having some areas that are there for the wildlife, you do want that. So if you're going to have some areas around the edge of the farm or pollinator strips through the middle, then having that kind of diversity is part of how you build resilience. So there's lots and lots of different ways that people are integrating animals, even if it just means bringing in some manure every now and then. That's way better than nothing. So those are some of the soil health principles. There are so many more. I always just, we come up with new ones every time we have a workshop by people just looking at what's going on in a natural system and saying, how could we integrate some of that into a farm setting?
Yeah.
Oh, I'll just say one other thing in terms of the diversity. When you have a diversity of plants growing all at the same time, you have very different leaf canopies. So you are, it's like having one of those mobile solar panels or solar panels that are in different parts of your land or your house at different levels, that no matter what's going on, someone's capturing that sunlight. And the more you can capture sunlight, the more chance you have to grow the soil sponge, because that's more photosynthesis happening. And that those different shape and height of leaf canopies are also helping to break the compacting influence of rainfall in different places and providing different nutrients for the underground life and the above ground life. So suddenly you have fewer pest insects and more predatory insects that are eating the pests. The system starts to balance itself out in ways that are predictable and unpredictably unpredictable. And those all are providing resilience against viruses and fungal diseases, etc. Same thing that we could eat carrots all day long, and no matter how healthy carrots are, if we only eat one thing, we're not feeding our microbiome and we're going to be unhealthy. Mm-hmm. So the microbes need a diversity of food. Mm-hmm.
Dee Dee, you've just talked about sort of looking at natural systems, ecosystems, and seeing what are the things that, how have these systems evolved, and are there principles that we can derive? And when we look at agricultural systems, they mostly are different from this. Lesser and more degrees contain some of these principles. How do you think we can move agriculture to, and this, I don't mean to, there's no reason why you should have the answer to this question, but I give you the opportunity. How do we move agriculture to be closer to these systems, to work better for all the things that everybody wants? Not everybody. There are some people whose primary goal is just to make a lot of money. Most of the farmers I know are just trying to survive financially.
Yeah.
But, and you know, there are some agribusinesses that are very, very successful. But if you're looking at something most people got into farming are farmers because they love farming, not because they thought they could make a lot of money at it. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But we live in a world in which bills have to be paid and you know, to stay in business. So do you have thoughts about models of success of how we can move the system? I know that you're much more involved in... I believe you're more involved in what's called the regenerative movement in the Midwest. And I know some of those people, you know, Gail Fuller came by my farm. That was a great pleasure. And I've met Gabe. But you know, that's a particular kind of farming and a particular ecosystem. I'm just curious. The idea of no-till vegetables, for example, is not impossible. We know that Brian O'Hara is doing it, but it's extremely rare at this point. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, there's literally a handful of people doing it. So
yeah.
I'm just curious, what are your thoughts? Because what we see is, in my mind, we see a world agriculture system that is failing, mm-hmm. and it's taking us all with it.
Yeah.
You know, the price of this failure is catastrophic. I believe that all stands between us and resolving it is politics and economics. When I say all, it's not a small thing. It's
right.
a huge thing.
Right.
But it's not about engineering. It's not about inventing something
new. No, it's
new.
Not a technological solution. Right.
It's not that we need a technological solution. We have the technology.
Yeah. Yeah, so, and we even have technology that can work in a more natural way. So we have equipment that can help to mimic a natural system rather than to destroy a natural system.
I
think getting at this question of what are the policies, what are the politics, what are the low-hanging asks that we can make that will help to shift things in the right direction. I think that if I could snap my fingers and have things change overnight, I have one ask would be that farms all have cover crops. That just keeping the soil covered would make such a difference in terms of soil structure and function. And it would make such a difference in terms of cooling, and which influences weather flows, continental weather flows, that I would be happy if we just saw that all agricultural land has cover crops on it. There is no bare soil other than, as things are transitioning from one to another. There are folks who have figured out even how to do it without even any bare soil, because something's coming up and something else is being planted, et cetera. So, and Walter Yana has calculated, and this is kind of in theory, but I think it's very worth paying attention to, that if we increase transpiration by 5% worldwide, that would be enough to offset the warming that we've already seen. And John Norman has kind of tweaked those numbers to look at, well, what does that mean on agricultural land? And that means 25% more green growth, whether it's length of green, size of green, amount of green, 25% more on agricultural lands worldwide. Is that achievable? I think that's achievable when we look at how much bare soil there is. So if that's the reward, that's huge. And as we see, that's not just cooling. That is not just cooling through the water cycle, but also it's helping to establish more soil carbon. It's providing all the benefits that we saw in terms of flood resilience, drought resilience, etc. Not fully, it's not going to fully restore the sponge. So cover crops is my first ask.
So for a civilian listening to this, because I hope some civilians will, what does that mean that the soil is bare so much of the time? They don't understand, how did the soil get to be bare?
Oh, well, I mean, first of all, there's an idea in farming for a long time, I think it's even in the Bible, that we need to fallow the soil, let it rest. And rest is super important, but there's a difference between resting it with plants growing on it and resting it bare. And so currently, keeping it bare is what happens. And the second thing is that plowing has been for for thousands of years, plowing has been part of a lot of agriculture, not everywhere in the world. And at the end of the growing season, people have typically plowed the remainder of the crop under, or even if they've planted a cover crop, they will plow it under before winter and leave the soil bare for the whole winter season. So these are just kind of things that generations have passed down. This is how farming is. But if you look around, it's not what winter does. It's not what winter does. If you look around, it's not what nature does. Nature doesn't rake the leaves off the lawn either, right? So nature doesn't come through and scrape the whole top layer of this earth's skin off before winter. It doesn't make any sense. We don't do that with our own bodies.
Right.
So my second ask after cover crops would be diverse cover crops. So getting that diversity in there. And obviously, if we can do those both at the same time, even better. The third ask, perhaps, is to have those cover crops grazed down. And this gets to the question of how do we not spend all of our agricultural energy growing corn and soybeans that then has to be harvested and shipped somewhere else, but bringing the animals onto the land to graze the tops of the plants down low enough so that there's still something growing there through the winter. The animals have been fed and the manure is already on the land and it's not being tilled up so that the manure can actually sink into the pores as it rains and bring the nutrients down to the plant roots rather than into the rivers and lakes and oceans. So no tillage or low tillage is a big important piece of this. However, if you start there, then you are often starting with also applying a lot of herbicide, a lot of Roundup or glyphosate or other herbicides. A lot of the big corporations have said, oh, we're doing climate smart farming, we're doing regenerative agriculture, etc. But they're using a lot of pesticides, biocides, fertilizers, etc. And they're just taking one little piece of this system. So
the no-till piece.
Yeah. And I think a lot of people aren't aware when they hear, oh, this they've converted to no-till, that that doesn't mean no-till organic. That means that you're using even more herbicide to kill off the crop. So, but there are a lot of ways to do no-till without having to use herbicides. It's rolling the crop down. There's grazing the crop down. There's a variety of things that you can do. So even just harvesting the cover crop, but leaving stalks there. So without having to till it. I think if we're just going to ask for one thing from a policy or a politician, those are the cover crops and diverse cover crops and more creativity in terms of what you're doing with a cover crop when you're ready to have your next crop, so that you can do it without disturbing the system and without adding chemicals. That's pretty key.
Can I ask another question? I have read, and I believe it's true, that 99% of America's meat, milk, and eggs come from concentrated animal feeding operations, from confinement operations, whether it's dairy or beef or pork or poultry, eggs. So in that, the food that is fed to the animals is grown somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
And it is shipped sometimes transcontinentally.
Yeah.
Right. And, you know, that's why they're, you know, whacking the Amazon is to grow, you know, soybeans for animals. So could you talk about why that doesn't work in your mind?
So you were asking about the CAFOs or confined animal feeding operations and growing corn and soy in other places, shipping it in, and then having these terrible systems that are both cruel and unhealthy for the animals and for the people who are living in the area and who are also eating that food. That's a big question. And I think that's, what I see is people splitting into vegan and omnivore. And I think we need to like bring that conversation back around to what is the role of grazing animals in a growing soil, in a healthy landscape, etc. What is the cost to animals that maybe aren't so cute and whatever, or you know, lovable as a cow or a chicken or a hog or something like that? What is the cost of growing the corn and the soybeans? Because when you till the soil, when you spray herbicides, you are killing millions of mice and voles and then birds that are used to eating those, and foxes and weasels, and also the soil microbes, etc. So, and you are killing tons of wildlife in lakes and streams and in the ocean. So if we really want that ethical approach, as a healthcare provider, I had lots and lots of vegetarians and vegans in my practice looking for nutritional advice. And I often would ask them, what's driving this? Is this a spiritual decision? Is it an emotional decision? Is it about your own health? Is it about environmental health? And great answers, wonderful, thoughtful answers. But I think there's just a lack of information about what it takes to make a block of tofu, you know, and also about, like, is it possible to grow meat in a system that's creating more life, more diversity, that's helping more animals thrive in the landscape? And I think yes. I think actually a grassland needs to be a grassland. It needs to be managed for biodiversity. And part of that management is having grazing animals. You don't have to choose to eat them. I mean, that's a whole other question. But do we need animals grazing that grass? Yes. The efforts at prairie restoration that don't include grazing are a matter of, like, removing invasive plants, you know, rather than letting the system balance itself out a lot. That may not be a fully accurate depiction, but my sense is that we get these little patches of prairie, but we don't have the expanse that we need to have wild animals roaming there anymore. We don't have the buffalo, and that yet people don't want to put grazing animals on there because they say, oh no, that's not natural. That's not what used to be there. So there's a lot of kind of nostalgia for preserving something or restoring something to a certain date without really understanding that what we're looking at here is, are living systems going to continue in any way, shape, or form that are recognizable to us? And we need to get really clear about what are the jobs in a landscape? Who's doing that work? Someone needs to graze a grassland, right? Someone needs to pollinate a natural landscape. Who's going to do it? How are we going to do that? How do we make a system where everything gets to participate again?
Okay. Well, Didi Purseth, thank you so much. It's really been fun to talk with you. We started this probably 5 or 6 years ago, and you taught me a lot at our very first sitting, and I'm still learning from you, so thanks very much.
Thank you, Dave.
Thank you for listening to the Real Organic Podcast. We hope that you will subscribe, tell your friends, and leave us a rating and review. A video version of this interview, as well as the full transcript with links related to our conversation, is found at realorganicproject.org/episode37. Please join us next time for an interview with soil and climate scientist Walter Yenna, founder of Healthy Soils Australia. To find a real organic farm near you, visit realorganicproject.org/farms.